Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. I'm glad you've tuned in today. Since the rape allegations against Seattle's mayor came out a week and a half ago or so, people have been asking, what does this mean for the leadership of this city? Well, today we got a clue. The former mayor of Seattle, Mike McGinn, has now entered the mayoral campaign, and Mike McGinn joins us live. Welcome.
Glad to be here, Bill.
Glad to have you in. And I know you want to talk about your platform, and so do I. First, we want to know, were you planning to run against Mayor Murray before these rape allegations became public?
You know, I've been, I would say about 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, me and my team really started taking a hard look at the race. And I've been thinking about it before then, but we decided we're going to sit down and really start looking at it from every angle. You know, there are things I care about, things I want to run on, and that's what we spoke about today.
But a coincidence, you were already into this.
Well, you know, we always look at the lay of the land, right? But I guess what I'd say about that is we don't know who else is going to come into this race before filing day. We don't know what this is going to look like, and it's very hard to predict how any of this is going to turn out. But the reasons I'm running are because I didn't like the direction the city was going, and I hope people can see that from, you know, the experiences I've had and the things I care about, that I can, you know, come in there and try to make a difference.
We're going
to, but
talk
I expect
about
other people to do the same, and okay. I hope other people do the same.
And we will talk about that direction of the city. One more thing, to catch listeners up, a Kent man has sued the mayor of Seattle, alleging that Murray raped him over a period of years. The Seattle Times revealed two other men have for years made similar claims against Murray. Importantly, the mayor denies all of these allegations completely, says they are completely baseless. So, last Murray question, should the mayor resign?
You know, that's a question the mayor, you know, that Ed has to answer. I think that every 4 years we have a campaign for mayor, which is really a public debate about the future. And if we miss this one, and this city's changing so fast, I don't think we can wait another 4 years for that discussion. So I think that's what I've been focusing on.
Okay.
And I'm not trying to answer any questions about what Ed should do or about the accusations. That's in his court.
Mm-hmm.
The public wants a debate about the city. That's what I want to promote.
Yes. You said a moment ago that you didn't like the direction of the city. Mayor Murray's accomplished a lot of things I think you like. $15 minimum wage, and at least he talks up the developers paying for affordable housing and subsidized preschool and more. Why does he not deserve a second term?
Well, the mayor is certainly, and I supported 15 as well, and it's great that he followed that through. And I think I can point to things that I also appreciate that he's done. But what we're seeing right now is rents are, you know, just going, you know, through the roof right now. I think over the last 5 years, the average monthly rent has gone up over $600 a month. Housing
Should
prices.
Should Mayor Murray take some blame for that, you're saying?
Well, we need a stronger response than we've had. And the criticism I have, and I do appreciate that he launched the effort and brought experts in, but there was a group that he left out, and that was the public. And he announced a grand bargain, and it was completely top-down, and I think a lot of those recommendations are now mired in controversy.
And how did the grand bargain suffer from a lack of public input?
Well, because you can't tell the public that there's been a grand bargain and that they don't have a say and not expect them to respond. And that what we see is a city council.
This is a deal on densifying the city and having developers pay for some affordable housing.
It's not even clear what part of the deal is even alive or not alive. But one of the things I learned as mayor, and I had to deal with some of these issues as well, and these were things where I changed my approach. One of the things I learned is that when a mayor comes to a community and says, this is how it's going to go, it rarely goes well. If you really want to make change, you have to include the people most affected. And that's whether that's land use and zoning, whether it's police reform, whether it's safety on the streets.
Doesn't the public seem to like Mayor Murray? He's been doing well in the polls that I know of, and they keep saying yes to his asks.
Well, that's a great pundit question for your guests to come up here.
We will punditize in a moment.
You know, I'm coming in because I'm hearing from a lot of people that these are things that they're concerned about, and I've been getting a lot of support for coming in and raising these issues. So we'll have the debate. We'll find that out. That's why we run the race.
Voters had a chance to keep you as mayor 4 years ago, and they said no thanks. Why would they want to reelect you now?
Well, Bill, I've had a lot of time to reflect on that 3 years. And I think when I was in the job, I was growing in it. We got a lot done. We got a lot of support in that race, too. It was a very closely fought race. And I really appreciate who supported me then. You know, if you look at the demographic maps, it tended to be younger people and communities of color and renters that, that gave me support then. So I was really, you know, proud of that, frankly. And those are the things I care about, and those are the types of voices and the types of concerns that I'm trying to bring into the race.
Well, speaking
and so
of people
they can
of color,
listen to me and make a decision.
Yeah, there is. Nikita Oliver is running for mayor on a platform of equity. She's an attorney, an activist, has worked on social justice and equity in Seattle for years. Why you instead of her?
You know, she's a very strong voice for change. And I have a great deal of respect for anybody who gets in the race. And she's going to make her case to the public, too. I bring a different set of experiences, having been through the experience, having learned how to balance a budget in really tough times, you know, having to deal with police reform issues directly, negotiating the consent decree, what it means to be the manager of, you know, both your police force and your human services division. And those are the types of experiences I'm bringing in into this as well.
Seattle Mayor Ed Murray says, quote, in response to your campaign today, Mike McGinn's divisive and confrontational style led to years of paralysis, dysfunction, and infighting at City Hall. What did you do wrong in your first term, and what would you do differently?
Well, you know, I mean, I can get on the stump here and start telling you all the things we got through council. Right, we got paid sick leave through council. We balanced the budget while protecting human services. We added the number of police officers, even though budgets were tight. We had reforms like law enforcement assisted diversion and directed patrol, where officers were on patrol in hotspots. First local hire legislation. We dramatically increased the amount of hiring of minority firms in the city. I think this issue of divisive, not divisive, turns a little bit on who you ask. Because what I heard from a lot of people was for the first time they were really included in city government. And I think some of the folks that were, you know, kind of coming from the powers that be felt like they weren't getting their way as often. You know, something like vetoing the panhandling legislation. You can say that was divisive if you like. It had 5 votes and was supported by the majority of the council and the chamber. But I think that was the right thing to do. So I think you have to take a look, you know, not at labels, but take a look at what I worked for, what we got done, and what we hope to do.
There's nothing you want to say that I will do this. I know you said you were growing into it, but
right.
Can you tell the voters,
sure.
I will
sure.
do this differently from what I did before.
Absolutely.
I will work with the council differently, et cetera.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, I'd never held elected office before, Bill. And I think I was coming in there with, I'm going to change everything at once. And I probably did rub a few people the wrong way. But I do think that if you look at the record and, you know, my first year versus my fourth year, I think you saw a lot of changes in how I dealt with folks. So that's part of it. I think I mellowed a little bit. I had a chance to reflect on all of this. And now I come into it with a fair bit more craft about how to do the job that I didn't have then. And a deeper respect, frankly, for what it means to make change in a big city. Because it's not just the council. You know, it's all the advocates, it's all the interest groups, and it's the other players as well. And yeah, I got an education in that. City invested in that education in me. I'd like to put it back to work for them again.
My guest is the craftier, mellower, more educated, so he says, a former mayor of Seattle, Mike McGinn, who today declared he is a candidate this fall for being reelected to the leadership of this city. So finally, let's say you become mayor. You got decisions to make. Sanctuary City, yes or no?
Absolutely.
Any changes?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Right thing to do.
What can you promise will happen with the city's homelessness?
We are going to make that a priority. First thing we're going to do is we're going to go through the budget. And, you know, the budget's gone up 25% in 3 years, $250 million of new dollars. And we're telling people we don't have the resources. We have to go out and do yet more regressive taxes.
Do you fault Mayor Murray for that, either wasting money or the wrong kind of taxes? And what would you do differently?
You know, I just think he brought an Olympia style of budgeting to the city hall. And, you know, we in city hall have, you know, and I'll commend the city council on this, too. I mean, they substantially adopted the budgets I proposed. We rebuilt the rainy day fund, and we looked on how we could save in order to invest in new things. Now we have all this new money coming in. Mayor's office budget has gone up 80%. You know, if you look at the council and the judicial branches, it's gone up too. And on homelessness, we declared an emergency in one of our richest times in history, and then asked the feds and the states to feds in the state to come up with the money.
I mean, Mike McGinn,
we need to focus.
Like a fiscal conservative.
I've always was a fiscal conservative. I had to be as mayor. But I think we have to be a fiscal conservative for a reason, because we have the most regressive local property taxes almost in the nation, certainly at the state level, but even the local ones.
What do you do about that? You don't raise any more money on property owners? It's all businesses?
That's the next part of the platform. So if we go through the process, first, we really look at where all the new money is going, look to prioritize first. To the extent we need new money, and I'm sure we do, I think it's time for the big companies that are doing so well, you know, the people that want to move downtown because they want to hire our people, you know, our creative, diverse people. I think they can help pay to mitigate the effects of growth.
Well, everybody would love to milk rich companies. What would be any different under your leadership?
Well, we'll do it. We'll actually ask the council to do it. We're not going to say it's off the table and keep going back to sales and property taxes.
And you're proposing a city income tax, which may or may not be legal, right?
May or may not be legal. So, I mean, I want to go on the record as saying I support it because people really want one.
Yeah.
What I do is, you know, urge the city council to craft the most legally defensible one they can, pass it, and let the legal challenge begin. Let's find out if that's a tool. But in the meantime, I think we can look at how do we raise the tax on the biggest corporations and increase the tax exemptions for small businesses. They're getting the same squeeze that homeowners are getting, right? Their rents are going up and their costs are going up and their taxes are going up. So, you know, give a bigger exemption to small businesses, tax the big businesses, and put that money towards our priorities. But again, the starting point is after we prioritize our own budget first.
You've been listening to the latest candidate for the mayorship of Seattle. That is Seattle's former mayor, Mike McGinn. And let's bring in some other journalists into this. David Croman, city reporter for Crosscut, and Heidi Groover, city hall reporter for The Stranger. Thanks to you both for sitting in and listening and asking more with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Heidi, what do you want to react to, what you heard from former Mayor Mike McGinn, or ask the former mayor?
Well, I want to know more specifics about how you're going to address homelessness in any way different than what Ed Murray has done. This idea of finding programs that aren't working and cutting them and spending more on the programs that are working. He spent $100,000 at least on a study to find those exact answers. So what exactly are you going to do differently?
Well, one is I do support the idea of 24-hour shelters. I think that gives a lot more stability to people. And I know that we've seen at least one nonprofit move to that model recently. The city's been trying to move, but has had delays on its navigation center. So that's a thing that it's a change in policy that would probably cost more money for some of these entities that are only doing evening shelters now. So that's one thing I would like to see, absolutely. I would like us to reform our sweeps policies to be as compassionate as possible when we do them. That was an issue when I was mayor. We worked with the advocates to come up with a better policy. Colloquially, it's the Al Poole memo is the issue. So we would do that as well.
Protests for that as well,
I
right?
Did face
people
protests
camped in front
that.
Of your house, so right. Didn't necessarily have a better track record than Ed has.
Well, I would say they did come to my house, and I came out and I spoke to them. But I don't think I certainly wasn't sued by the ACLU. I certainly have not seen, I did not have that expose that the Seattle Times wrote because we did work harder to do them well, and we did fewer of them as well. So it is controversial. I don't want to deny that, and it's difficult. But getting back to your question, too, you know, one of the things I fought for as mayor was the idea we have to get some type of temporary housing available immediately, and was resisted by the council. Lost that one 5-4 more than once, going back to this divisive issue.
Yeah.
But when Sharma got elected, we got it to 5-4 yes, and we started doing that. So those are the types of things I think we need to be much more innovative about how we use our existing land and dollars to immediately get people into housing. And again, that maybe mean more resources and it might mean more controversy, but we have a situation right now where people just can't believe that their parks or sidewalks have camping on them. And I think we need to get back to, we need to, as effectively as possible, fulfill our ideals, which is to provide shelter and protect our parks and open spaces for the recreation purposes that we had them for.
David Croman, Crosscut.
Well, and on that, I mean, you faulted now a couple times Mayor Murray for calling too much on the feds or too much on the state to handle what you seem to be classifying as sort of Seattle's problem. But when you look at the West Coast, all of these cities are really struggling with this. And so, I'd like to hear your defense of why that doesn't make sense to call on the feds or the state for more help.
I think it was just a politically pragmatic one. And I did get a little bit of criticism back when I was mayor of, oh, McGinn wants to go it alone. And it wasn't that I didn't want as much help from those entities. But when I was in office, it was very, even when I was in office, the feds were cutting the community development block grants. And that was under a Democratic administration. That's what we were seeing. So with a Republican Congress, that's just not in the cards that that's going to happen. You know, the state is facing the McCleary issue and a very evenly divided Congress. So the criticism is more just from a political, pragmatic analysis of the likelihood of getting more dollars. Should they help more? Absolutely. Is it a problem that extends beyond our borders? Absolutely. But we are fortunate to have this really strong growth in the city for a lot of great reasons. We have that growth. And so that's why I think that we wasted time as that wasn't a good judgment call is what I'm saying.
David and Heidi, I want to talk with you more about some of the big issues that this city is facing. Mike McGinn, final question. Your slogan is "Keep Seattle." Keep Seattle what?
Well, I know. Everybody's going to get me on this one. But one way to look at it is we don't want to lose it. We don't want to lose what makes it special. So let's keep it. Let's keep Seattle for the rest of us, for all of us. Let's keep it affordable. Let's keep it diverse. Let's keep it creative. Let's keep it open and inclusive. Let's keep it a place where, people can live their lives, whether they grew up here or where they're coming here to find opportunity. Let's keep Seattle.
Mike McGinn, running again for mayor of Seattle. Thank you for coming in and talking to us about it.
Glad to be here.
Now, Mike McGinn is going to move away from the microphone so that we continue to talk about him. But not just Mike McGinn, but Ed Murray and what faces this city in general. Again, I'm talking with David Croman, city reporter for Crosscut, Heidi Groover, the City Hall reporter for The Stranger. Now we all know what Keep Seattle means. Keep it for all of us.
I really cleared this morning.
Do we know what it means?
Yeah, affordable, diverse, creative, open, inclusive, and for all of us. Heidi, what surprised you from former Mayor Mike McGinn about Mike McGinn 2.0, his 2017 run, platform, and pitch to the voters?
I think what surprised me was, he's always been a neighborhood advocate going back in his career, but when he takes that lens and applies it to the city's current discussions about growth, and he criticizes the current mayor's housing affordability plans, it results in him calling for more neighborhood process, talking about development. And I think everyone in Seattle can agree that we've been talking and talking and talking about housing and development. And so it makes him come across as wanting to sort of slow down the progress of building new housing. And that's not sort of the urbanist argument that I think I necessarily expected from him.
David? That said, when he was speaking at the press conference this morning, it came up as to whether or not he supported adding duplexes and triplexes in single-family neighborhoods in Seattle, which was an original proposal from Hala, but it got so much blowback because it was right around the same time as city council elections that current Mayor Murray sort of dropped it pretty quickly, and that was a big sticking point for a lot of the urban community. So I agree with Heidi that his sort of emphasis on neighborhoods has been really interesting and not necessarily expected, but he still does have these strains that suggest, at least to me, that he's willing to go a little bit further in that sort of, we need more density, we need more development strain than Murray showed himself to be.
After the allegations that Mayor Ed Murray had sexually assaulted juveniles in the 1980s, there were reports of other candidates possibly entering the mayor's race, right? We immediately started wondering, what's this mean for the leadership of this city? Is this the candidate that you expected, Heidi?
No, it's not. Now that it's happening, it seems like an obvious window for Mike McGinn to try to get back into city politics again. But I think there, first of all, are more candidates who are going to come forward. And
do you have any names yet?
No, I don't. But stay tuned. I think this week you're gonna hear some news. And so I don't think this is the end at all of sort of figuring out what this election landscape looks like.
Well, it strikes me too that, it's the filing deadline to run for mayor is mid-May. But realistically, for somebody to mount a mayoral campaign, this would have started months ago. So it's really late in the process. So it's surprising just because he was the last mayor we had before our current mayor. But at the same time, it's not surprising because for somebody to actually successfully do this, they would really just need to kind of activate a base that they already had, because I just really don't think there's the time for somebody to build out a whole brand new campaign in the coming months. So people know his name. People have worked for him before. He's got donors who have given him to him before, people who have endorsed him. So he's sort of picking up later on in the game than somebody else might be.
Okay,
and there's an already built-in sort of narrative since they've run against each other before, which is Ed Murray is establishment, Mike McGinn is sort of an outsider, and people already have those emotional connections to the two candidates, and I think you're going to see those same arguments come up that came up last time.
So for now, be odds makers. Other candidates, haven't weighed in. You think they will, but where would you see the voters going at this point?
I got a text message from somebody this morning who sort of knows some of what's, connections to the McGinn campaign, and she suggested that there was some polling that they had done. I haven't been able to confirm that, but they were saying that it looked positive. I don't know if it was a definitely going to win sort of thing, but clearly what they had looked at was encouraging enough to them that it made sense. So I have no idea who's going to win, to be honest, but somebody thinks it's a good idea.
I think it's very likely Mike McGinn makes it through the primary election. The question is whether Ed Murray makes it through the primary with Mike McGinn, or if we see a sort of split to low enough percentages that we're surprised and we see two non-incumbents against each other in November.
So we have everything that Mayor Murray has accomplished and whatever his detractors say about his time in office, and we have these rape allegations, which again, Mayor Murray completely denies. How do you at this point see them playing into this Seattle mayor election, Heidi?
Well, I think that it's clear Mike McGinn doesn't want to talk about those allegations against Ed Murray, but I don't think he really is going to have a choice. I think at every event, Ed Murray is going to be asked to answer for the allegations against him. I think probably new information is going to keep coming out as that case progresses, and so it's going to stay in the news. And eventually, I do think the candidates running against him are going to have to come up with something to say about it.
And similarly, I think former Mayor Mike McGinn is going to be spending a lot of his campaign defending why he is not being opportunistic in this. It was the first question you asked him. I think that is going to continue to be the first question he gets asked is, are you just doing this because you sort of see a wounded duck?
Particularly if he's struggling to really call out Ed Murray in very specific terms for what he's doing wrong. Again, back to what you asked him, what can you promise concretely that you would do differently, either from your last term or differently from Ed Murray? And he's going to have to really hone in on that message, or it's going to continue to look incredibly opportunistic.
Heidi Groover from The Stranger, you mentioned the establishment and outsider narrative. Who do you think the establishment supports now in this fall?
Well, we haven't seen a sort of fleeing away from Ed Murray from, big labor unions or any of his big donors. Before any of this happened, he'd already raised more than $300,000. I think that some people are going to stick with him. And so, and he definitely has his roots in the Democratic Party establishment in Washington State. And so he's going to continue to be the establishment candidate unless a lot of new information emerges in the case, a lot of his supporters sort of run away from him, something like that. Otherwise, he remains the incumbent and the establishment Democrat.
And David, how significant do you think Nikita Oliver's support is, and where does she draw from?
I think that's going to be really interesting because, if you looked at her campaign kickoff recently, a lot of the people in that room were McGinn voters in 2013. And so it's a question. I mean, Nikita Oliver is a little further left than even Mike McGinn. I mean, you don't hear Mike McGinn sort of calling for phasing out the police department as Nikita Oliver has done. I don't know the answer to this, but the question is sort of, how large is the left? How big an umbrella is that? Is it big enough that enough people can split off from Mike McGinn to the left and he can still have enough of a support? Or is he going to sort of fall in this void in between people who want somebody sort of more aggressive on some policies like Nikita Oliver and someone who's a little more, who likes to brand himself as a pragmatist or whatever, as Mayor Murray does? I mean, is there enough space in there for him to pick up enough voters? You know, it came up at the press conference. It's been since the 1920s, since the mayor, or since Seattle has had a female mayor. I mean, I think that's a legitimate question. Do Seattle voters really want a race between two middle-aged white guys? I'm not so sure about that.
Let's wrap this up with any final thoughts. Heidi Groover from The Stranger.
Well, I think what David just touched on is one of the things that's sticking with me is just in what ways will Mike McGinn set out to distinguish himself in terms of, you know, issues that affect women, for example? Is he going to come out with strong gender pay equity policies? Is he going to come out with strong paid parental leave policies? Because he does have to make the case, and Ed Murray does also, that the city should continue electing a white guy as mayor.
If we polled the city council right now, who do you think they'd rather work with, Murray or McGinn or Oliver?
I think Ed Murray. The sure. Majority of them have already endorsed him.
For sure. And a lot of them, well, not a lot of them, but a few of them have sort of bad memories of the times that they worked with McGinn. He had a reputation for not always getting along with the council. And I think even the people that weren't there at the time sort of fall into the same categories as some of the people who were there at the time and sort of had a difficulty working with him as mayor. So definitely if the vote was up to the Seattle council, Ed Murray would continue to be our mayor.
Crosscut City reporter David Croman and The Stranger's City Hall reporter Heidi Groover, as you both said, this conversation is going to look different over weeks and months. There could be new candidates. There could be new information. There will surely be campaigning and arguments to be made. So let's just keep writing about it and talking about it together, okay?
Will do.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks to both of you for coming in on KUOW's The Record. Much more to come, including what happens if services like Uber and Lyft go union. Stay tuned. It is safe to say that nobody at Safeco Field expected this. A concession stand there started selling toasted grasshoppers for the first time this year, and within 3 days, sold out. That's 18,000 grasshoppers. That's a lot of legs eaten by baseball fans. The Mariners are now imposing a per-game limit on grasshopper orders for the rest of the season. And Safeco's not the only place you can get insects to snack on. Just go to Eugene, Oregon, where Kraft Crickets is selling locally raised toasted crickets. But KLCC reporter Brian Bull reports they have not yet seen Safeco Field-level demand.
Have you ever eaten a bug before?
That's Austin Miller of Kraft Crickets. He and co-founder Zoe Antone are at an Audubon Society gathering in Eugene. They're hosting a table covered with pamphlets on crickets' nutritional qualities. Antone offers small plastic cups containing samples.
These are dried roasted crickets. We raise them right here in Eugene.
One woman warily eyes the cups of bugs. She is
Joyce Baker.
Are you part of the Audubon Society?
I am. I'm the cupcake maker. This is my competition tonight.
Miller smiles and engages Baker.
Can I interest you in trying some?
I'm a little squeamish. I'm embarrassed as an outdoorsy person to say, I don't think I want to put a bug in my mouth.
We'll get back to the Audubon Society and see how those cricket snacks go over later. Now it's time to visit Kraft Crickets on site. It's in West Eugene, right behind a Burger King.
We're going to take you on a little bit of a tour, starting at the beginning of cricket life. So we'll take you into the nursery.
Zoe Antone opens up a small, humid tent. Austin Miller emerges.
If I dig a little hole with my finger, you can see how there are maybe 50,000 eggs in this 8x8 pan.
And this stage is called pinheads because they're the size of a pinhead.
The next room is stacked floor to ceiling of nearly 200 plastic totes. Miller figures they have 940,000 crickets here.
They only make noise when they're full adults, and it's just the males doing their mating call.
So I just recorded a few thousand guys saying, hey, check me out.
Yep, more or less.
Miller and Antone met in London. He's a former finance manager for Amazon, while she worked at a sustainable development consulting firm. Last year, they put down $25,000 for this warehouse space of 2,400 square feet. That may seem sizable for crickets, but Miller says it's nothing compared to what's needed for a beef steer.
To raise a pound of crickets, you need around 15 square meters. Cows, you need around 200 square meters. And crickets only require 1 gallon of water to create a pound of meat in the end. Beef, you need around 2,500 gallons of water.
Kraft Crickets doesn't have a slaughterhouse. Miller says they're only licensed to raise them on site. For harvesting, they use a local kitchen down the road.
And the crickets being cold-blooded, when you move them into a freezer, they'll slow down their systems, and if it's below freezing, they'll go into a hibernation.
Within 24 hours, the crickets die. They're then cleaned, blanched, and baked.
That's removing the water content so that you get a dried cricket that you can keep on the shelf for over a month.
Kraft Cricket's mission of providing more sustainable forms of protein is backed up by the United Nations, which released a report in 2013. It argues eating bugs helps alleviate environmental impacts as well as hunger. Some researchers, including May Barenbaum, head of entomology at the University of Illinois, say there's further justification for eating bugs.
It's essentially been in our DNA for millennia.
Barenbaum says our manual dexterity and brains evolved from our ancestors seeking out ants or termites from nests and grubs living under bark. So crickets aren't really a big stretch for us to snack on.
And in most ways are better suited for the human diet than our more conventional sources of animal meat. Crickets have all the essential amino acids. It's very high quality protein.
So Anton says the younger someone is, the more receptive they are to eating a cricket.
One of my friend's 2.5-year-olds, when we gave some to her to try, she just started taking handfuls and stuffing them into her face. And then we did a little test between crickets and her Cheerios. She chose the crickets every single time.
So let's go back to the Audubon Society, where we left Joyce Baker ready to try her first cricket.
Someone should hold my hand.
Don't look at it. Yeah, there you go.
Yum, 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 yum. Tastes a little like sunflower seeds. It's tasty.
Are you a convert?
Well, I'm very curious about how it would be ground up into smoothies.
Or your next batch of cupcakes.
Right, exactly. I'll surprise people. They'll say, oh, you put some nuts in this time. No, just a few little bugs.
Other Audubon Society members like them too. One woman declined, telling the Kraft Cricket founders she had just brushed her teeth. Miller and Anton say they'll keep pushing the benefits of crickets. A telltale sign of a convert is a sticker they hand people after a successful sample. It simply reads, I eat bugs. I'm Brian Bull, reporting in Eugene.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9, Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle wants to become the first city in the country to allow Uber and Lyft drivers to unionize. Uber and Lyft don't like the idea. Some drivers who don't want to unionize are suing the city of Seattle. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce is suing Seattle, too. What does all of this mean for you as a passenger and as someone who cares how businesses and employees are treated? Well, here to help us answer that is Felix Salmon, who's a financial journalist and a senior editor at the pop culture site Fusion. Good to talk with you again, Felix. Welcome.
Hey.
Now I hear you, Felix. Good. So, first of all, Felix, how could a union change the way that Uber and Lyft do business here?
Well, it would force Uber to actually sit down and talk in one way or another to the people who are providing the service. You know, right now Uber effectively just dictates the terms upon which under which people drive, and if you, it's a like it or lump it deal, right? That you can either drive for Uber, in which case you take what they give you, or you don't drive for Uber. And if there was a union, then Uber would have to sit down with that union and talk about things and say, well, what do you want? And would have to listen and would have to sort of make decisions as to whether or not they wanted to respond and how they wanted to respond and to what degree they wanted to do things nationally or just in Seattle. And so it would be a very, very different way for Uber to act than it has done until now.
You make Uber sound like quite the high-handed company in the way they deal with their employees.
Well, yes. And they, you know, they were famously high. They have been famously high-handed for a very long time. In fact, they don't even consider the drivers to be employees. This is a key part of their business. Like how they see themselves is just as an intermediary, putting together passengers and drivers. And the drivers don't work, aren't employees. The passengers aren't employees. They just kind of use this platform to find each other. There are definitely people out there who consider this to be a little bit disingenuous.
Isn't that just how the modern market works? If you can just get these parties together and you have drivers willing to drive for X amount of money, then what's the problem?
Well, the problem is that the drivers have no say in how they're treated. They can't, you know, ask for better working conditions, better wages, you know, insurance for when they're not carrying a passenger, or any number of other things which might not even cost Uber a lot of money, but which might make Uber, you know, the drivers' lives easier. The point is that Uber doesn't even want to listen to the drivers in that way. They have no interlocutor who can represent all of the drivers, and so they just make the decisions themselves in the best interests of Uber, the company. And if the drivers don't like it, they can just lump it.
And passengers would notice a yes on unionization with higher fares, or I suppose Uber or Lyft just leaving the market?
Well, Uber has threatened to leave the market if the drivers unionized in Seattle. It is not an idle threat. They threatened to leave Austin, Texas, if various laws were passed there, and the laws were passed, and they did leave. So probably the biggest effect that Uber passengers in Seattle might see is, if this goes through, then Uber might actually end up just turning off its entire service in the city of Seattle.
We've been talking about Uber and Lyft. Do you make much of a distinction between them? Or are they just as one pretty much just like the other to you?
In Austin, they were very similar. You know, they both said they would leave if the regulations passed, and they both did leave when the regulations passed. Lyft has much better public relations. It's not famous for being evil in the way that Uber is. And a lot of people who hate a lot of the things that Uber stands for use Lyft instead, because it basically does exactly the same job without a bunch of the sort of really sort of douchey Silicon Valley connotations that Uber has. But yeah, ultimately the service they provide is pretty fungible. And as we've seen in Austin, even if both of them leave, it's pretty likely that other services will spring up to fill that vacuum.
I've been talking with Felix Salmon, senior editor at Fusion and a financial journalist. And Felix, we've been talking about drivers. We're actually going to meet a couple of them now. Will you stay and listen to their stories and react?
I would love to.
Very good, because with me here in the studio are Deborah Jeffs-Grad and Takela Gobena. Deborah is a part-time Uber driver and is against unionization. Takela drove Uber full-time for 3.5 years and now works for the Teamsters Union. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Takela, why did you get into driving?
When I started driving for Uber back 2013, I left airport job to drive for Uber. Basically, Uber had been doing advertise at the time, promising you will make 25 and above an hour. At the time, I used to make $8 something minimum wage at Cedar Airport. So I left that job to, you know, make a better wage with Uber.
Mm-hmm. You left your job driving taxi at the airport?
At airport, I used to do what they call a wheelchair service, wheelchair agent.
Okay, and how did that new wage actually work out for you at Uber?
Initially, back in 2013 and beginning of 2014, it was okay. At least that we were able to make not 25, not above, but we were able to make 15, 17, sometimes less. The fare used to be much better than what it is right now. As day goes forward, the wage, the treatment, everything start declining, going down. Right now, it's at worst condition.
So, as a driver and a Teamster, why is this union necessary? How do you think those, you're not driving now, how do you think drivers' lives would change with unionization?
Well, I stopped driving about 2 months ago. I've been involved a lot with organizing drivers over the last 2 years and a half. I involved in community. This industry, majority of this industry is immigrant community, low wage workers. I involved with them on daily basis. We eat the same at the same store. We shop from the same store. I see their daily life, basically their activity on daily life. Most of them live on this work. They manage their life, income, almost everything of related to the income based on this business.
This is a full-time job for
many drivers. Exactly. Full-time job is the job that helps them bring bread and milk to table at home. And I still continue to get involved to improve this working condition for my community. It's not just about me. It's about the community.
Deborah, why did you get into driving?
I'm a retired registered nurse and psychiatric social worker, and I took up a new hobby, which is weaving, and I also like to travel. And so on a fixed income, Uber provided the extra money that I needed to take travel and to support my hobby, my habit, actually.
We've just been hearing some pretty negative things about Uber. As an Uber driver, how do you react to that?
I respectfully disagree with the man in New York. He said some pretty harsh things, and that has not been my experience with Uber at all. He said that they never talk to drivers. Well, Uber has a peer advisory program, and the peer advisor drivers have actually influenced Uber a great deal in terms of the platform and the support and how they deal with customer complaints or rider complaints. Uber has had neighborhood community meetings, and I think that they have improved their support staff in terms of when there's a problem or when we ride in. And so I think Uber does listen to drivers, at least in Seattle.
Felix Salmon, are you working off an old script? Is there an indication that Uber is improving its driver experience?
Well, they've done a number of things, including setting up a kind of quasi-union, which they're trying to use to prevent a full-on, sort of slightly more oppositional union. They have had a lot of very bad press recently, especially as regards the careers of women at the headquarters and various other scandals. And so they're making an effort to try and become a little bit less evil and a little bit more friendly and make it seem as though they're listening more. But ultimately, they have made it absolutely clear that their long-term vision is basically a vision without paying any drivers at all. That they're trying to just position themselves for a driverless car future, and that they're just going to navigate this world of drivers for as long as they need to until they can get rid of them altogether.
Well, in the meantime, Deborah is one of those drivers. And Deborah, you're not interested in a union. Why is that?
I'm not interested in a union because the way that it's working or the way that they've set it up is really quite not a standard union practice. I've been a union member before. So the city, you know, is dictating all the rules. The union's behind it. The union donates to the city council hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, for their campaigns. I've never been in a situation where a city has dictated to independent contractors that they need to entertain the union.
How would it affect your life if Uber went to unionization?
Well, let's start before they go to unionization. Just the fact that they've set it, the rules up the way that they've set it up. The one that I'm the most concerned about is the privacy. So that the deadline is passed and a judge made an injunction that said that Uber did not have to turn over to the city of Seattle my private information. The private information would go to the city of Seattle. Seattle would turn it over to the Teamsters, which means that for 90 days, not like one day all in the same place a vote, but for 90 days, they can come to my house, they can stop me in the parking lot, I can say no, they can come back again, I can say no, they come back again. They have 90 days. And I wonder how many people will just feel that they need to sign the card to get rid of the harasser and to feel safe again in your own house. And I would be very angry if they came to my door and disrupted what was going on with my family.
And I understand you think you would lose your flexibility, the flexibility you enjoy under a unionization scenario.
I'm absolutely sure that I would. The stated goal of the Teamsters Union is to improve the lives of taxi cab drivers. What's the best way to do that? Get rid of the competition. And so if you think about it, they also have tried in the past to limit the amount of drivers on the platform at any given time. They think there are too many part-time drivers on the platform. I'm a part-time driver. Most of the Uber drivers are part-time drivers. And that means that if they're trying to make minimum, well, I'm going to back up for a second. The city and the union have both stated that the first thing that they're going to negotiate, if the union comes in, is a minimum hour criteria. So a minimum hour. That means that I immediately have to leave the platform or work these minimum hours, whatever they are. That means I don't have the say anymore about where I work, when I work. If I'm tired, I don't work.
Takella, what about the loss of flexibility for drivers like Deborah?
I think a lot of drivers know this. Speaking honestly here, I myself have been a full-time student over the last 3 years and a half that I've been with Uber. I have a family, I have daughters, I have a time to spend with him, full-time student. I also work for Uber and Lyft at the same time. I've been doing internship every year while I'm in school. So this all based on flexibility that we have with Uber. And almost every driver agree with that flexibility. Union support, union agree with that flexibility. There is no a single point over the last 3 years that I have been involved with the drivers, with the union, and with other community members, where union or drivers or community members say they want to limit that flexibility. The idea that the union limit flexibility is a big wrong.
Felix Salmon, senior editor at Fusion Financial Journalist, you're hearing two different versions of life under a union with two different Seattle drivers. Any comment on this?
It's striking to me that the anti-union side of the debate is really is like a driver who sees other drivers as the competition, and the pro-union side of the debate, more classically, you know, is a driver who sees other drivers as all, you know, the group of contractors who are being used by Uber, and then Uber is the other side of the table. So my sympathies would probably be more with the union on this one. I feel like the massive drivers in Seattle have more in common with each other than they are sort of competing with each other, and that if it's true that the hourly wage, the amount that you get paid every hour to drive on the platform, has been going down in recent years, then it is surely in the driver's interest collectively to try and stop that decline.
And I see Deborah raising her hand. You can't wait to react to that.
Thank you. I think the vocabulary is a problem here. I do not see that other drivers are competition. There's a difference between being a taxi cab driver and being a driver for a company. Then you are a worker. And as an entity, you have a lot in common with your other taxi cab drivers. I'm a small business owner. I fill out a Schedule C. I pay self-employment taxes. I'm not a worker. And so I think that it's difficult for me to get my head around a city and a union who's trying to make me a worker that somehow needs to be rescued or taken care of when I'm a small business owner.
And a satisfied one, Felix.
And that's awesome. And, you know, I have a certain amount of sympathy with this point of view, and obviously, in a when you have a workforce as diverse as the number of Uber drivers in Seattle, you're going to get a range of views there, and that range of views should be represented by the union if unionization does happen. That I agree that the union should not represent purely the people who are using Uber as a sort of effectively a full-time job, but should definitely represent the interests of all of the drivers, including the ones who might only drive for a few hours a week.
Then I would say that means that every driver on the platform should be able to vote, and that's not the way that the rules are set up.
To Callum?
Yeah, speaking of that, I think it's very clear there we can see on the initiative that the minimum requirement for the drivers to vote to qualify for voting is having provided 52 rides per 3 months, over 90 days,
52 rides over 90 days.
Over 90 days, which means less than one ride per day. Drivers out in this city, most of drivers, at least five and more rides per day, even part-time drivers.
Takela, do you feel you're taking a risk here by possibly pushing Uber out of the city of Seattle?
So by any means, me, myself, and other drivers, we are not pushing Uber or Lyft or whoever out of business or out of city. What we are asking is very three simple things. We are asking Uber, Lyft, a voice. We are asking them a dignity. We are asking them a respect and better working condition. This is a simple thing we are asking. But unfortunately, what Uber is saying is, no, we're not listening to you. And even right now, what's happening is challenging the city initiative. They are actually exposing Seattleans, people of the Seattle, for extra a cost, because the public tax is going to defend that initiative in the court, and it's going to put a cost on the public again. So we're just asking simple question. We're working for you. We're spending 16, 80 hours on the street doing the best we can. Just give us a voice, dignity, respect, and better work condition.
Final question, Felix Salmon at Fusion. What are the odds that Uber actually pulls out of Seattle?
I would have said they were low until I saw what happened in Austin. And now I think they're quite high if the unionization happens, which, you know, is obviously a big if and is right now in the hands of the courts. Uber does follow through on its threats. This is unlikely to be a bluff.
That's the big if. It is in the courts, and we're going to keep watching it. Felix Salmon, financial journalist, senior editor at the site Fusion. Always good to talk with you, Felix. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
And Deborah Jeffs, grad, a part-time Uber driver, and Lyft as well, right, Deborah?
Yes.
You work for both?
Yes.
Okay.
I do not work for both.
Thank you. You work for yourself.
I have contracts independently with both platforms.
Thank you. An important point. Uber and Lyft. And Takela Gobena is now not driving, but working with the Teamsters on this unionization issue. I want to thank both of you for coming in live and talking with our expert and talking with me and talking with our listeners about how this unionization vote might affect you. That's our time for now. Thanks to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Thank you for tuning in. Please join us right here again tomorrow.